Screens at all?
Can I see them?
Yeah. Okay.
The screens? Yeah.
Yeah, because there's gonna be a presentation we'll get to.
Okay, thank you.
I just wanna make sure you can see it.
You're good.
I'll move if I have to.
That's fine. Any citizen comments?
I do roll call.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay, Boyd Frederick.
Here.
David Holman. Not here. Andy Berg.
Here.
Aaron Decker.
Here.
John Franco.
Here.
John Poole.
Here.
Michael Skalitsky.
Here.
Emma Heller Kavner.
Here.
And then Alexandra Hera is excused. Mm-hmm.
And if you want, there's Supervisor Wambold here as well. Okay. Chairperson comments. Real quick, I will be attending the legislative conference with WCA and will not be at the next county board meeting because they happen to land on the same day. Also, I said this at the first meeting, and I'll repeat it here, is the resolutions we're looking for are resolutions that deal with Kenosha County, maybe in support of something or coming up with a question or a solution for something. Like if we come up with something for the roads, that's a state issue, but it affects Kenosha County a great deal. And just so you know, with the state assembly, all they're doing is committee hearings right now, and their first assembly session will probably be the week of the 7th while I'm in Madison as well. Okay. Any supervisor comments? Anybody? Okay. Any communications?
None.
Okay. Approval of the minutes from the last time we met, which was a while ago.
So moved.
Second.
Okay.
Well, you can have it, Decker.
All right. November
15th. Yeah, I was looking going, wow, it's been months. Okay. I was aware of that. All in favor of approving the minutes, state by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Real quick, I had printer issues, so I couldn't print out the letter I had. What I'm looking for is a paragraph from you explaining your political experience that will be handed to the legislator working with. And I will be doing that when I'm up at the Capitol. So you have a couple weeks to do that.
Can you repeat that again? What'd you say?
I have a letter that I couldn't print it out due to my printer having some issues. So I'll be sending it to you, or Emily will be sending it to you in the next couple days. And then if you could stick a biography in of yourself and then what you want to let them know about you. So, sorry about that. I spent 45 minutes on it last night trying to get to work.
And is this a letter that's going to the individual we're supposed to be?
Right, it will be.
Developing the,
yeah. So if you want to, what your interests are and everything else, whatever you want to put in there, you'll put it in there. And you can make it as long or as short as you want. And like, basically, this is who I am. You know? That way they have an understanding of you a little bit better. Okay.
When do you need this by?
I'm going to be printing them out the weekend before that, so the weekend I think is the 4th of February. And next, we have Chelsea from the County Association giving us somewhat of an overview. I did exactly that the way I wanted to.
Hi.
Hello.
I don't know if you can see me. I hope you can hear me at least.
We see you in the corner.
All right, good. Okay, so thank you for having me. I'm excited to be doing this. I'm basically just going to give you a little election and legislative update. Can everybody see the presentation as well?
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right, so to start with, we're going to have a little election recap. This is a chart here that shows us that the Wisconsin voter turnout actually was at a record low since before 2004. The higher years are the presidential years because that's generally when people show up more, but it was a little surprising to see that it was a record low. To get a little bit more detailed, this is how voter turnout dropped in each county, and it kind of goes off of the legend by the percentage. Stock County was the only county that actually increased from the last election as far as their voter turnout went, but every other one was definitely lower. This is an example of the how the county voted left or right overall in the 2012 Obama-Romney election. And then to compare, this is the counties voting right or left in the Trump-Clinton election. So we put them side by side here just to show pretty much how rural Wisconsin really influenced this election, and you can see a lot of significant red there. All right, so then in this slide, we just wanted to show kind of where each county moved right. And the darker red it is, the farther right it went, I guess, comparing it to the last presidential election. And then there's only four counties that were considered moved a little farther to the left, which would be Dane County, Waukesha, Milwaukee, and Ozaukee counties. I hope that this the chart and the legend is understandable. It's basically just comparing and putting it into a little more detail for us. We're going to jump into the Wisconsin State Senate. So there are four new members of our State Senate after this election. This kind of gives you a good visual of the bodies that are there and then in which party they're at. These are our four new members. The underneath in parentheses is who had the position before them. Each of them beat out the incumbent except for Dan Fine because Rick Gudeck died this last year. It has their district and then their party as well. There's only one seat that switched parties, which is Patrick Teston's seat. The Republicans gained a seat here because he took the Democratic seat and he represents District 24. These are our Senate leaders currently. Roger Roth he's new as far as the leaders go. And then we have our Senate Majority Leader, Scott Fitzgerald, and our Minority Leader, Jennifer Schilling. Here's a body count of our Wisconsin State Assembly. There's 11 new members of this one, and then only one seat swap again. These are our 11 new members, as well as the district that they represent and what party they're in. There's a little bit of a formatting issue with the system, but this is the seat that got switched. So overall, there was two party changes that went overall. So it was district 92, and I believe it was 24. These are our assembly leaders. The Senate Majority Leader, it's supposed to say assembly. He's not. But these all stayed the same as far as this session compared to the last. This is a chart that we decided to put together that kind of shows the number of Republicans that we've had in our state legislature, and this chart goes all the way back to 1951. We actually haven't had this much of a majority in the Republican Party in state legislatures since 1955. We're going to jump into the legislative status a little bit. Our new session began on January 3rd. Right now, it's a lot of bill introductions and committee work. The governor just delivered his State of the State address on January 10th, where he kept his promise to absolutely not raise taxes, especially or even in transportation, which is a really hot button issue right now. And the state budget is likely to get introduced. It's scheduled for February 7th, but they do have the ability to change it, I believe, up until like the 31st, but we are planning for it to be on February 7th, which is when our WCA legislative exchange is too. There are five new committees that have been added: urban revitalization, science and technology, federalism and interstate relations, government accountability and oversight, and regulatory licensing reform. We have five returning members who did not receive a committee chairmanship at all. These chairmanships are assigned by Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. We have two new members of our Joint Finance Committee. So anything that goes through the budget usually goes, well, it goes through the Joint Finance Committee. And these considerations start in March, and they go through to June at about that. So these are the two new members. As far as our WCA activity goes, we are generally just meeting with agencies, the governor's office, different leaders to focus really on our priorities, which are in the legislative agenda as well. We're making introductions with our new members of the state legislature, and there's 15 of them, so we're making a lot of meetings and trying to get a lot of this in. We're meeting with committee chairs, oversight, to discuss oversight of county issues, and then we're identifying bill authors for some of our legislative proposals. So things are moving along. These are our proactive priorities, which we'll be really focusing on. They're all in our legislative agenda, which I believe was given to you. Each of these go into our platform as issues that we support, and each lobbyist focuses on their specific issues, which kind of ties into, if you have specific questions, I can absolutely get that question written down and get you the answer, even if I don't have the answer. So these areas here are a lot of our hot button issues that we're going to be focusing on this session, and some are fiscal and some are not. So. And last but not least, we do have our County Ambassadors Program, which is our CAP team. And if I'll go over it quick, just so for those of you who don't know what it is, we work side by side with our government affairs team. So we have four lobbyists. We promote our agenda, and we meet with the lawmakers, legislators, and we encourage them to really focus on county issues. And they really get to talk to the people that deal with it every day. Our CAP team meeting dates are January 18th, so we have our first one tomorrow. Starts at 9 a.m., and then April 5th and October 25th. If anyone is interested or had not heard of this, I'm not sure about how the membership or the registration goes, but we absolutely love the more the merrier. We want to get as many people involved and get these legislators hearing from real county people. So. As that is, I believe, all I have for you. I hope that you do, I mean, if you do have questions, I hope I can answer them. Otherwise, I will absolutely write them down and get them to you as soon as I can. Do we have any questions at all? Does anybody want me to send the... Does everybody have the presentation or any information in particular they want?
Chelsea, this is Mike Skalitsky. I had a quick question. On your WCA proactive priorities, there's eight of them. Can you, since we got a little bit of time, can you expound a little bit about what, what the approach in general, or is each one unique in and of itself to its approach?
Well, I definitely think that you have it right when each one is very unique, and each person really gets to dial in and focus on what they're going to do and who they're going to get to author certain bills, who they can get to support them. In our legislative agenda, they go into a little more detail as far as what we're asking for. I know we're asking for a pretty, our biggest fiscal ask is for the child welfare funding. Transportation funding, we're really just trying to get them to focus on giving us a sustainable amount, not something that's maybe a lot right now or a high percentage, but then it goes down to 1% next time. We want it to be a sustainable solution.
So
I know 911 funding is very, we're really trying to.
So with the, with your transportation funding, as an example, since you've mentioned that one, has there been a strategy or plan that's been put together by either the lobbyist or the team that's responsible for that particular priority?
Yeah, I mean, I know that Dan Barr has his strategies. He is absolutely our transportation guy. He's actually at the highway conference right now talking to them about what our plans are here come the next budget. But I can absolutely get Dan to kind of go over it with you. I mean, he's got plenty of time. I don't know his way of doing things really, but I know that each one of them kind of has a system that works really well for each of them, especially in their own areas.
Okay, so
I know that Dan has a lot of information on it, and he's actually presenting it today.
Okay.
So I can get him to send you some stuff.
No, I was just curious if they had shared any details with you, and in general, they just kind of gave you, hey, here are the 8 areas we're going to be proactively working.
Well, I guess I'm not really sure what you're asking for then. I mean, I know that I don't know a specific amount. We didn't really ask a specific amount. We didn't ask for a particular amount of money. We kind of want to let the legislators decide that. We just want them to give us something sustainable. I know a little bit about each area as far as what we're asking for, but I wouldn't be able to get into great detail about any of them in particular, at least not right now.
Okay. Thank you.
But I could get it for you if you would like that. I could absolutely get you that information.
Yeah, that'd be great. Certainly in transportation, I'm interested in shoreline zoning changes. I want to see what the ideas are there. And bond thresholds,
okay, yes,
too.
Both of those are Dan, so he can definitely get you that.
Okay. And then also bond thresholds.
Okay. How about maybe, Emily, if I could just get all this information and just send it to you, or...
That works perfect.
Yeah.
And then you could just get it to everybody?
Yep.
And then the other one, somebody mentioned they want a little more information about the bond threshold.
Yeah, that was me.
Okay.
What is the joint agency statute?
That is a statute that we're working on. Basically, right now, there is a statute that accidentally basically takes away the ability for two county departments, whether it could be something in human services or their jails, if they want to combine them. Right now, it makes them split the money, or only one gets it. I don't know exactly what it is, but I know that it's taking away our flexibility, and we want to just say, give counties the option to decide, yes, we want to work with other counties in this department and not others, instead of combining them all together.
Okay.
But let me look at our agenda here and get the information that we have.
So that would be basically like allowing us to do what the state has told us to do with the extension.
Like we have it right here. I don't know if you have our ledge agenda in front of you, but one of them is basically says we want to adopt authority for counties to organize independent of state mandates and allow us to provide regional services and not have to go off of the state mandates and requirements, give us the flexibility to work with the other counties or the other region that we want to work with. So yes, I believe that would fall into that category.
Two things. Do you know about Tom Weatherston's bill when it comes to Act 10?
Sorry, I couldn't really hear you.
Tom Weatherston right now, Representative Weatherston, has a bill when it comes to Act 10 and dealing with the counties. Do you know much about that or no?
I don't, not currently, but we do. We did just release our Capitol Watch today, so I can see if there's something in it. But no, I don't have any information on that at the moment. Unless it's not fully been released yet.
I don't know if it's been released or not. It was just something I heard about.
I don't think so, because I'm looking here and I'm not seeing anything related to Act 10, but I can write that down and for sure get some more information on it.
Okay.
One other thing, what's the CVSO grant program?
So our the county veteran service officers, when they spend certain, basically there's a grant program that allowed them to spend the money, and they would spend this money and not get reimbursed back for what they were expected to get reimbursed for, because then it would come back here and they would say, no, we're not gonna provide you money for that. So now we just want it to go back to allowing them to spend the money, have the county executive sign off on it and say, yes, this was for our veterans in our county, and then it gets sent here and they get the money, absolutely. But before it was just kind of a big mess and the CVSOs weren't getting reimbursed for the money that they should have been getting because they were providing it for the veterans. So we're just changing it back to what it was, and there was just some sort of more issues and consequences of things that may not have been intentional but ended up affecting what they do.
Okay. Thank you.
And I also, we have lots of issue papers. We have like specific issue papers on each of these and more detailed ones too. I will get those and I have them on my computer and send them to you as well, Emily.
Okay.
Because those have a lot of detail on what these priorities are.
Okay.
Shared revenue, have you heard anything? What's going on with that? Because the governor has been saying no increase in taxes, but yeah, he's also been saying there'll be increases elsewhere, but nothing, anything about shared revenue.
I can't say that I would know anything about that at this point, but that's another one that I'll write down. All we have from him currently is what he put into the state of the state as well, but they might, since we are having more meetings and more appointments, so they might have one scheduled next week where we might get some more information. I know that we have a lot going on, lots of meetings with different people, so I will put that down and say that we want some information on what the governor might do with the shared revenue.
I know some of you are reading through things. You want to glance through them and let's have Chelsea wait a minute, or?
And if anyone does think of another question when I'm not on here right now, absolutely feel free to send me an email. I know that Emily has it, but I can go back to the slide that has it on there, and then I promise that the answers to you, I just don't know all of them, but I can hound them to make sure that we get the answers to you as soon as possible. My email is at the bottom there, and that's our office as well.
Does a 17-year-old going into adult court and the reimbursement, is that part of your agenda as well?
Yeah, it is. There we go. Basically, I can't find it right now, but it is. We just want to have 17-year-olds be able to be tried, not always as an adult, but in juvenile court. So that's another one. We have a really detailed, Sarah Diedrich Kasdorf has a very detailed issue paper on it. That is, she's so good at what she does, and I will absolutely send all of those so that we can get those sent out to everybody as well.
Any other questions?
Supervisors, I know you're going through that thing with a fine-tooth comb.
Here we go. I found the part about the 17-year-old offenders in our thing, our ledge agenda here. It says, increased funding allocated to counties for juvenile justice services to fund all costs associated with bringing 17-year-olds first-time nonviolent juvenile offenders back to the juvenile justice system instead of charging them as adults when they're nonviolent first-time offenders.
Chelsea, give the committee, they're looking through the ledge agenda, so hold on a couple minutes while I look through it, okay?
Okay, no problem.
On page 7, under taxation and finance.
Okay.
The fourth one, it says, enact an exemption from levy limits for economic development efforts. What does that mean?
I believe that it goes along with the one underneath it, where it says we want to modify our annual levy limit. But I'm not, I can't say that I know how to give you details that are correct. But Kyle Christensen is he focuses on the tax and finance. So I can absolutely, that's another thing that I can for sure get you some more details on if you want me to.
Well, is there, like, I guess reading through these bullet points, it would be nice just to know, like, the reasoning why, and I'm just going to pick one that I see. Increase medical assistance reimbursement rates for behavioral health services. It'd be great to know why we're asking, why the WCA is asking for that. You know, what's the reasoning behind all these bullet points?
Okay, yeah. So
Do you have something like that?
We have our WCA platform,
okay,
which has a lot more detail. I don't have one with me. It's on the computer because it's a lot of pages long. But this is just like this year's section of it, and then our newer points that we want to focus on that aren't already in our agenda or in our platform go in there. So that is where each lobbyist kind of gets into more detail about why they're choosing that amount, why they're choosing what they are, and why they think it helps counties. I think it's on our website as well, but I can double check on that.
Okay.
Why? Okay.
You know, like, picking one, like, exempt county government-owned IMDs and state-only licensed facilities from the provider bed assessment, the bed tax. Why are we doing that? I mean, is it really negatively affecting counties? You know, the reasoning behind it would be nice to know why.
Yeah, I mean, I know that that's going to be, I mean, this is shortened up so people know what our agenda is. We do sit down and discuss what really does before we even put anything in here. We sit all of the legislative team down and go through each and every resolution that we're sent, each issue area. And I know that there are specific negative reasons why. Some of them might be just unintentional consequences. Some of them might be worse or a lot worse. But I do know that we do have documents that have all of that explanation down, so I can find them for you.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, after Supervisor Wamble, then.
I have a question for you. On page 6, under public safety,
okay,
on the far right, it says, enact statewide legislation prohibiting the enactment of local ordinances restricting the residency of sex offenders. Can you elaborate a little on that? Is the state planning to take over, so to speak, the placement of sex offenders throughout the state?
I thought they had already enacted laws that did it.
So I'm wondering what this means.
It sounds like that, but I would think that it would be the other way around.
Can I?
Go ahead.
Because I can answer that and talk a bit about Supervisor Decker's
question.
Oh, great. Okay. Go ahead.
So, really, the issue that we found was that all these localities made these ordinances preventing where people could live. Well,
some of that problem could be alleviated by the way state law defines sex offender, but obviously there are other procedural moves that the state needs to take. So basically what we're saying is get it off the backs of localities and you deal with it because it's really your problem. And this is the way that we begin to do that.
You said get it off the backs of...
of localities, because they didn't want to touch the issue in terms of working on it.
When you say
they being the state.
The state didn't want to touch it.
No,
okay.
So it ended up going to cities, counties, towns, and villages, and, you know, then people made restrictive ordinances because you can't have so many, you know.
Right.
So,
it doesn't seem to be working. That's why I was wondering.
Well, the state just passed a law not that long ago stating what the parameters are, and if your local ordinance was stricter, you had to go to those state levels because... there were counties where there were basically nowhere a sex offender could be placed.
Right.
And so the judges were placing them outside their own residence of the own county.
Yeah.
And that was restricted also in the language that you cannot place a sex offender outside the county.
In essence, you're in effect banishing someone so they can't live anywhere. Right.
Well, see, that's happening right now.
Yeah. No, the state law changed.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's why I was wondering why I was in here, if there's going to be more changes coming.
I've heard that they're going to clean up some of the stuff from from 2 years ago.
That's definitely true. Some of the stuff is just cleaning up, like he said, but some of it is all new as well. So it's just hard because I just started. A lot of these, I mean, some of the lobbyists have been here for years and years, so they remember what it used to be or what things. I don't know. I'm working on answering your questions, but I will absolutely get you the more details. I don't have it on the top of my head.
Thank you.
I just want to talk a bit about the legislative agenda, and, you know, and because I've been around WCA for a number of years now. What you're looking at on those pages is the result of the work of not necessarily just the lobbyists, but also other county board supervisors around the state who found something they got passionate about, and county staff who wanted to get more involved than just it being a 9-to-5 job. And so the result of that is what you see in front of you. So a lot of this, you know, I would suggest calling some of the committee chairs. WCA does publish a book of every single county board supervisor in the state. So you have that at your disposal to begin to make use of it. And you'll begin to know and understand with great clarity why all of what you see here is here.
And we do, and that's a good point, is we get resolutions and all of this goes through our board of directors and it goes through a lot of people.
Our own human services staff have talked about how they don't like the bed tax because it increases the expense on us as a county to do what we're trying to do. They want it gone.
And do you know if they're planning to eliminate it from both private and the public sector? Or
I have no idea.
Because the way that I read that one, like, sounds like just the public sector.
Yeah, we definitely wouldn't be going to change anything in the private sector, more than likely. At least it wouldn't be in our agenda. We wouldn't be opposed to it, but... So is there any other questions at all? I plan to, right after this, go get the PDFs of all of our issue papers that we have. We have a binder full of them that we give to different people that we're having meetings with, legislators, offices, that really go into detail, and you can choose to read the specific ones that you want or all of them. So I can for sure get that to you right away.
Can you include something else on there as well? And you're going to hate me for asking this, but I think because of the issue of funding that has come up, it might be helpful for you to also include the relevant informational papers from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, because that'll give a very, very plain and thorough background that I think our committee folks could make great use of.
Okay.
Thank you.
I got it down. I can do that. Does anybody else have anything that they want me to look into at all?
Anybody else?
No, I think we're all set.
All right.
Okay. And I will either be getting you the responses, Emily, or making sure that I have one of them email it to you.
Okay. That works.
So you can look for that in the next couple days here.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And sorry I couldn't answer more than I could, but I will definitely get you all the information that you need.
Perfect. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
A couple things that were mentioned by her. I don't know if anybody else watched the State of the State, but Kenosha got mentioned for doing 7,900 jobs in the last 3 years, leading the state. And she talked about the CAP team. We actually have two people going to Madison right now for the CAP team, and that's the county clerk, Marisha Krebs, and clerk of courts, Rebecca Matoska-Mintic. Because they decided to put most of the meetings for the CAP team at the same time as our county board meetings. Not our fault. So, Supervisor Berg, if you want to get the gentleman from Parkside.
Yep.
You start since you get your resolution.
Okay.
Either one want to sit in the hot seat?
Whoever's got the better answers.
Might take both.
And your name, sir?
John Jaroszewski. I'm the Assistant Chancellor for University Advancement at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Resident of Pleasant Prairie. Have been for probably 20 years or so.
Okay. All right, so what we have here is a resolution in support of UW Systems 2017 and 19 biannual budget request. And what spurred this on was an article in the paper, I think it was actually a Gateway paper, that further went into the Kenosha News after that, referring to a lot of the structural repairs that needed to occur at Parkside. I know in the last budget, biannual request, it was $30 million for the
jumping right into the nitty-gritty. We're going to bring this is Mel Klinkner, Vice Chancellor of Administration.
And so after reading that struck me. I just graduated from Parkside, so I figured I'd send an email out to Chancellor Ford, and we've gotten to the point to where it's been shared with the city of Kenosha and also Summers, and they've also passed it. So we ask that these two gentlemen grace us with their presence and answer any questions that anybody might have.
In the budget, I'll just give you a general, and John, I think, maybe give some of the highlights, because we're really proud of Parkside, and I don't want this to be a long, drawn-out meeting for you or anything, but we could go on and on about Parkside. I've been there 5 years now. I'm a first-generation student. That's why I chose to come to Parkside to work. And just milk cows over in Minnesota for years. That's where I was born and raised. And I just feel like giving back here, and Parkside's does a great job with students from Kenosha, Racine. John has all those statistics. And so the budget itself is in two pieces. It has an operating budget of $42 million, you see probably in your materials that you already have. And then there's a capital budget that you can look at. It's $700 million if you count things like dorms and residence halls that students pay for. You take that off, it's about $460 million. That would be state-supported buildings. As Andy mentioned, Wiley Hall is a part of that $460 million. It's a $35 million project right now. 2 years, the last biennium, we had it as a project, and it was $30 million, and it's already escalated. The scope of the construction project has not changed one iota, and it's already gone to $35 million. So the longer you delay these kinds of routine maintenance projects, they continue to escalate. So I don't know what specifics you want. We can get into where, what's Parkside doing for the community and how well we do it, or down to the specifics and nitty-gritty of the budget.
Well, I just think from my perspective, what drew me to Parkside and drew my son to Parkside, who will graduate this spring, is the local connection it has. Oftentimes, I think we take things for granted. We're just under 50 years, and I am proud to say that, you know, over 60% of our students today come from Racine and Kenosha County. So 30-some percent come from Kenosha. All people with a bachelor's degree in the county of Kenosha, 20% of those have Parkside degrees. Congratulations, you're a Ranger. You know, that's a tremendous impact on our local economy, particularly as we look to grow and sustain the economic growth of our county, where I'm raising my family, having access to affordable higher education is key to developing the talent we need. We are the most affordable UW school of all the 4 years, which is interesting, and appropriate insofar as who we're trying to reach, which are those students that might not have other choices, and Parkside does a great job. On top of that, we have about a 90% placement rate in medical school and have for 40 years. So many of the doctors in our community, including the one that delivered my son and my oral surgeon, all have Parkside degrees, so we've done that well. We're also seeing 100% placement rate in our computer science program. 100% of our graduates in computer sciences are employed 3 months after graduation. So that also speaks to our ability to adapt to what employers need. So some of those things are why we're coming to you, ask for support, because to be clear, Parkside is a very, very lean operation. And without the support of the state, we don't have large reserves to operate on. And we want you to understand that we need this support from the state, particularly the $42 million or so that would come in terms of revenue.
For those who don't know, where is Wiley Hall, for those that don't know the university that well?
Wiley Hall is what houses the library, and it's that sort of predominant building on the landscape of campus with the glass walls. And it really typifies the architecture. As a matter of fact, it's quite a architectural treasure, and the rest of the building was modeled after Wiley Hall. So it does contain the library as well as the county, the state archives for Racine and Kenosha County. And that's what gives Mal pause, because when you think about the infrastructure need, including leaking pipes and 50-year-old plumbing, it really causes some concern. Also, it is a treasure on campus in terms of its significance to the architecture, and it also is a hub of activity that is outdated in terms of how it's designed. And so the infrastructure issues is phase one, and then the design features, creating access for people with disabilities to get up and down the elevators, gain access to the library. All of that hasn't been addressed in a meaningful way since that building was built, and all of this would do that.
And there's huge technology. I mean, if you walk through the building, I would say it's gorgeous. Beautiful views, everything else. But you have a whole area, it's called Mid-Main, and students sit there, but they eat. They can't. There's plug-ins outside the wall, but they can't use it in a technology way, a learning environment way, which is really what we need to improve on as well.
I would only suggest that insofar as making that a hub for student activity, accessibility, and all those features, including all the resources around financial aid, counseling, and all that, you need to understand 60% of our students are commuters. As I said, they live at home. They live right here. They're their friends, your neighbors, your voters, et cetera. We want to make that a hub where those people that are commuting to school have a place where they can anchor for the time they need to focus. They'll have the library right there, they'll have other resources there, and that's really the vision behind Wiley Hall, beginning with the infrastructure, meaning right. Leaky pipes, and Mal could talk at length about leaky pipes.
Or even falling light fixtures in my office last week. That literally happened, which is
So that's where now this project is of some level of importance at the university system-wide, because we are part of a system, so they stack up all the requests for building projects. Ours is what ranked?
Third.
Third, and it was approved in the last biennium budget, but we did not receive funding in the last biennium budget for any capital from the state.
Yeah, it goes through a very rigorous process for review through the system offices. You can imagine all 13 campuses, well, 26 campuses are pushing forward for projects. And we did get ranked fourth in the last biennium and third this biennium. So system, with all of their requirements and looking at design and needs, have ranked us very high. So it's not just Parkside saying we need this done.
So you mentioned that you guys had submitted this, because this isn't maintenance. This is a substantial renovation for $35 million.
Right.
Who did get funding on their capital projects?
Last biennium? No one got funded initially, but then finally Madison got a chemistry building, and that was it.
And that was partly supported through philanthropy, correct?
Yeah, part
so
of
that's how it was.
Yeah, some of it came from gift money, and when the legislature saw some money coming from gifts, they decided to fund it, but that was it. There was no additional money for what's called maintenance repair. They call it all agency. No money for that, no capital. So that is really, if you ask me what my major heartburn is, if I have a roof leaking or heating and chilling going out, I have no backup. The state has no money, system has no money right now, because by last biennium there was nothing funded. So so
in the, not the previous biennium, but the biennium before that, okay, budget, you may or may not know the answer.
Okay.
What was the capital requests and allocations for that budget? Any ideas at all?
You're not talking this previous.
No.
You're
one
talking two biennium before
13-15.
Yeah. I might be able to come up with the general.
And that's okay. I was just curious because obviously
yeah,
there's been.
Yeah, in 13-15, there was just under $400 million. And that would be, just a second. General fund supported would have been less than that. It would have been about $300 million, which is state funding. Then there's also the program funded, which means like residence halls where students pay a fee for that. So, yeah, it was about $400. And that had been sort of the number that had been going on for several years. And then it dropped off last year and only doing the Madison program.
How did Wiley find it? Because I get the impression that Wiley is in tremendous disrepair. How did it fall into such tremendous disrepair in 2 years?
In 2 years?
Well, you guys clearly have been getting capital investments for maintenance projects, right? Has it not been spent on Wiley?
It's been specific. Yeah. I could go on for a long time about it. But so part of the capital budget, and I can just give you the breakdown even right now on the $400 million. $300 of it is for... $344 million is for actual maintenance of major project level, like a Wiley project. Then there's only $100 million for all agency, which would be deferred maintenance. So if I had a boiler go out, I could go to deferred maintenance. I could make a request to state and to the system and say, hey, can you fund this for us? Because we have no heat in the building. And they could do that. The others are what called major project. It could either be a maintenance project, a major maintenance project, where you go in to redo the infrastructure like we're doing. It'd be the risers, all the stuff in behind the walls that have not been redone for years. We've had five leaks already in Wiley, and I'm just concerned we have a major failure. We could be in big trouble.
One of the things that was an enlightening discovery, what was it, 4 or 5 years ago, was the massive amount of reserves that the UW system had, okay? Can you speak to where those funds have gone and what are they doing with them?
So I wish I had all the data for that, but the big part of the reserves is money that was already allocated. Like on our campus, we have, as John already said, we have no reserves. Really, a reserve would be something that you have set aside that had no commitments. That was something that was missed in the whole thing. A lot of that money was set aside. It had commitments either for building a new residence hall, doing maintenance projects internally, things like that, that said, you know, it's just money sitting there as cash. Yeah, it's cash, but it has commitments or plans for the future. I mean, you can't, like a business, you can't have a product line and say, we're going to use that product line forever and ever. There's changes that you have to do to that line and whatnot, and renovate or maybe even create a new one. So we have ideas like that too, that we want to change programs, add new programs. That money was set aside for that. It's been spent down now. A lot of it's been spent down.
So of the roughly $700 million, obviously those are, that is a lot of major construction projects for $700 million. Do you know where or what your portion of that would have been in rough terms? Because obviously you've spent it, because now you don't have any.
You're talking about the reserves again,
yeah.
If you will, reserves. And I hate that term because it's not true. It's cash on hand.
Okay. Well, that cash on hand has a purpose,
I know.
Right?
It got that connotation, and it's absolutely wrong. It is cash on hand that any campus had. Like, we might have it, if we had a budget where I would feel comfortable, I would like to have $100,000 set aside for capital for new technology every year. I don't have that. I don't even have any in my budget. So if I had some cash on hand, that's what I've been using it for, is to do some technology renovation and things like that. So of that, you're saying of that whole $700 million, what would have been our portion?
Yeah, you're part of the system,
portion,
right?
Yeah, our portion is like probably 1% at the most.
Is there a reason that you seem, I get the impression you're kind of the redheaded stepchild of campuses here? Or is Madison just taking the lion's share, Madison, Milwaukee, because they got...
Well, that's true. I mean, just from sheer size, sheer budget, yeah, they have a lot of it. So when you were looking at the cash balances, a lot of it was at Madison and Milwaukee and other institutions. But when you combine 26 institutions who are all planning for the future, that isn't a lot of money. I mean, it sounds like a lot, but when you divide it up among that many, it is not that much.
Well, not every campus needs major renovation projects every year.
Right.
Or every
and the thing, let's make sure we understand there's an operating budget and a capital budget. So there's two distinct pieces of the budget. Last biennium, we got cut $250 million in the operating budget and received no capital other than the $82 million that Madison got.
And I think that's part of why we are going to each of the bodies, the governing bodies locally, is so you understand Parkside's context. The numbers roll up and they get very large. I've demonstrated the impact and the need in our community in terms of we are a local university. We are not bringing in students from all over the globe on average. We are bringing in students from across the street. And so we do want you to understand our context in light of those large numbers. But because we're in the system, as successful as this budget is, will be the success that we need. We can't do it any other way. We need the whole budget to succeed.
What impact has the tuition freeze over the last few years had on?
Well, we've lost about $7 million in base operating costs over the last two biennium. And for a small campus, that's significant. Obviously, the tuition freeze is great for students. I mean, first and foremost, student access is number one, particularly at a campus like Parkside. But it does cause some strain on our system. There's no doubt about it. Myself, I run the public relations department, the marketing department, the fundraising department, and the legislative outreach area. Just myself. Mel runs HR as well as all the maintenance area and obviously and the police. So we are very lean. And that's why we're here to talk to you. We understand the questions about the big numbers and the big sound bites that are out there at a state level. But the Parkside context is very different.
Yeah, I just wanted to sort of share what I knew. I spent a considerable amount of time at Parkside. And I recall that historically the school was supposed to be built in a giant X for 10,000 students and be a feeder school for Madison. But also, in part of its design, it had two other interesting components. One was that you didn't necessarily have a giant lecture hall with 100, 250 people that you didn't know. You know, it was maybe 30, 20, or 15 with a professor. And the other was that the way the offices were designed is that people from different disciplines could, you know, going out, getting coffee, exchange conversation, and different ideas would come about. So as a result of that, that history, some of which is still very much in place, when you hear the numbers from the state about funding in terms of system, like the whole thing about reserves, our schools are not part of that. Our school's always been small. It's always been different. And because of that, the changes that happen system-wide affect Parkside differently and more harshly and much more adversely. So I'm proud of Supervisor Berg for bringing this to our attention. Thank you. But the one thing I'll mention to everybody at this table is this. We may be the redheaded stepchild of system, but one of the things that system has loved to do over the last two decades is take our administrators. And that may include one day one of these gentlemen at the end of the table. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I would thank you for that. And we are a leader, considered a leader within system on many things. And I can just go from the finance side. Some of the models that we've created have been picked up by system and other institutions because we are so lean and we have to be very frugal and conscientious about how we spend every scarce dollar that we get. So I can assure you Parkside is very efficient in the use of our funds. And I appreciate you bringing up the tuition free because that's very difficult. I don't know all your backgrounds, but I always try to relate it. If you're a business person, and I told you we were going to freeze all of your revenue sources and ask you to have an efficient business. And I also said, you can't have any more capital. And besides that, you can't do any salary raises for your employees. Tell me how efficient that could you could run that business. And that's what we're being asked to do right now. So we're really made very hard decisions on our campus. That's why we wear so many hats. But we're doing it for our students because we want them to succeed.
Go ahead.
I just want to add one thing, and I don't know if you gentlemen have this information on hand. One of the assets that we have in this community with UW-Parkside is that we have faculty that do research, and sometimes that research can come from government grants. Yes. And I know we have had faculty that have received those and have reported on their research and such. I know I sent an email to someone's office asking for some information on that because I'd seen it other places.
If I might, the nature of our university is to teach students. That's the mission of Parkside. We do not receive considerable research grants.
No, but there are some faculty that have over the years and some currently.
Absolutely.
And I want to make sure that that story gets told. I know that there has been a long-standing fight in the faculty that is relatively newly resolved between research versus teaching and learning. But I still want folks to know, as part of that Parkside story, something is happening there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And all the research, I shouldn't say all, the majority of the research grants that we get, the faculty want them so that they are for students to be a part of their research teams and gives them that experience. And that's what we're excited about. And John failed to mention it. The success rate for the medical school compared to the nation is what?
Well, the current average acceptance into medical school is around 40-41%. And ours is at 89 just for medical school. If you add in all the other medical professions, it's about 90%, and it's been that way for 40 years. So that speaks of a rare form of excellence that you just can't find at any other campus. But I do think it's important that we are, you know, with this body, bringing home the local county perspective, and again, that's why I'm here. Our operations are extremely lean. You talk about the tuition freeze, but we make decisions based on student success. In the same amount of time that we've been cut by $7 million, our retention rate from freshman to sophomore year, which is a key indicator of student success, how many stay from freshman to sophomore year? It's come from the 50s up to the 70 percentile. And for African-American students, it's even a little bit higher. And so in that same amount of time that we've suffered these cuts, because of the leadership of Chancellor Ford, this guy with his incredible ability to spread money thin across the board and help us make good decisions, we're continuing to focus on student success and actually increase student success. We've added 40 new programs over the past three biennium that include articulation agreements with Gateway Technical College, so you can have a seamless transfer, save a lot of money at Gateway, seamlessly transfer, enter Parkside as a junior. The amount of agreements we have with Gateway are unheard of across the system. And it's a model for the system because it takes work on both parties to make those curriculums align. So when you talk about our context in light of everybody else, I submit, obviously, because of what where I sit, that Parkside is to be commended for its ability to stretch a dollar, quite frankly.
There's another concern, too, that the governor has talked about, not just freezing, but cutting tuition in the next biennium budget. Do you have any idea what percentage, what the wind is on that one?
No, we don't.
Or nothing.
That should be a concern.
Well,
I mean, it's good for the students, obviously. It's,
oh, yeah.
But if you're not going to get any more money from the state, and then not only are tuitions frozen, but then they're going to be cut on top of it.
Other folks in really his caucus have suggested that there would be, that the state would fund this.
Right.
But we haven't heard any details. They would fund the cut.
Oh, okay.
Explain to me why you think that state taxpayers should make up this difference and not students that are attending Parkside with their tuition.
We have a tuition freeze.
Okay, if you remove the tuition freeze.
Yes. Then what?
Why should state tax dollars be paying for this versus student tuition?
I think on average, public education is for the benefit of the entire state. And so the investment in the state dollars, the taxpayer dollars, fortify our community in and of itself for the 400 employees we have here, as well as I say, the local impact we're making on people's lives through a degree attainment. Additionally, we're really the talent provider for the region when you look at who's being employed and who they're employing. So when we look at creating a viable economy in your state, you want to have readily available
But don't
education.
You think the students who are actually using the college should pay for it?
On average, they pay more than the state does, and they have for quite a bit.
It used to be the state did 70% support and the students did 30%.
About a decade
now ago. Now it's this way, it's 30% support from the state, 70% from students. And I don't disagree with you, but I mean, we don't. What basically I feel like is they don't trust me to make a good financial decision that I'll gouge students with tuition, which is so far from the truth. I mean, we're business people too, and we wouldn't. But yeah, I think if the state doesn't want to support it, then somehow we have to let students support it. And I mean, so it's a mixed bag. I mean, we want affordability, and since we're a state institution, we'd like the state to recognize that students that live within the state should be supported because it helps the economy, and that's the way it used to be. Now it's kind of changed. But it's a great question.
I recall a report from our director of nursing not too long ago, where she looked at the babies being born in Kenosha County. And said that 45% of all the new babies being born are being born into poverty, evenly split into thirds. One third black, one third Latino, one third white. I would wonder what the kids from those families, what they want to be. I remember I was out campaigning and I met a little girl who wanted to be a lawyer. She's Latina. I said, that's great. That's wonderful. I said, once you do that, you set your eyes on becoming a judge. I'm pretty sure given the neighborhood I was walking in, her family could not afford to go to college. You really can't get a decent job anywhere without a college degree.
That's not true.
The vast majority, it is.
No, it's not.
It is if you can check the labor statistics if you'd like. The labor statistics say otherwise.
We can talk about that.
But the only way that happens is if someone has the ability to go. So I think it's incumbent upon us to support our own people. That just makes sense.
Yeah, I think I can talk from my own experience. I mean, I was a little farm boy, and my parents had eighth grade education. That's it, and they knew nothing about college or options for the kids. I was oldest of nine, and my dad told me growing up, he says, "Mel, you're not going to amount to anything if you don't learn to use your hands." And I was not good with my hands. My brothers were. I was not. So what was my future? I had no clue. Came out of the Army, had the GI Bill. I thought I'd try college. Fortunately, I had some professors who could guide me through because I didn't have parents there to do it. And fortunately, I had the GI Bill some way to fund it. My parents could not have funded it. And I would have never had the opportunity, just like the young lady you mentioned, to say, I want to be a lawyer. I didn't even know what I wanted to be because I didn't know there was anything else. But to be sitting here today doing what I do, if I didn't have some support somehow, I wouldn't have been able to make it. And so I think the state supporting education is very important, as long as we kind of call it a state institution, a public institution.
How much is tuition right now per semester?
It's probably about $7,000.
Well, it's $7,500 when you add in the student fees.
Right.
So basic tuition is around $6,300, $6,400 for annually.
Two semesters.
So it is one
very
of the
affordable.
Lowest in the UW system. And in considering our market and who we serve, you know, it would be hard pressed to raise it that much. However, we will raise it as much as we need to sustain quality, not to change who we serve, but rather just to sustain quality, because access and affordability, because what will happen if you raise tuition too high, the debt load will go high.
Your current request is for $42 million. In the last biennium, what was your request for operating budget?
Well, I can't remember that. It was a lot more.
How about the previous one? So two budgets ago.
It would have been more too, by far. A lot higher request.
So, $50 million, $55 million, $70 million.
I just can't remember that.
Okay, what have you guys done to bring that? Obviously, become a little bit more efficient with the money you got, because inflation has kicked in. We're 2 years now, 4 years removed, right? But now you're asking for less money. What has the Parkside campus done to make itself or allow itself to operate on less money?
Well, what I've done, and it's one of those models that we talk about at UW System, is I removed some silos in our marketing area because that was my purview, and consolidated marketing across the university, bringing them out of individual units and bringing them together. A consolidated marketing budget so I could maximize the impact of the marketing budget, because I come from private industry. I was in public affairs in a corporate setting, so I understand efficiencies. So I brought together that function and actually have generated more marketing for the same amount of dollars than I would have alone. I also consolidated other functional areas inside of myself, so we didn't have a separate standing office. And so the foundation and the fundraising operations all report to me. Mel has the same scenario. He and I, in particular, because we're that sort of what would you call overhead, we were really aggressive in terms of streamlining our operation. Another example that you'll appreciate if you're in a corporate setting is every one of my direct reports to me. So I've took out middle management, which would be a corporate practice. And so I've created a flatter organization with slightly better talent, if you will, at individual roles, but they report to me and they have a lot more. So a state environment might not have budget managers at that level. I've given everybody their budget so that they're accountable. They don't have supply budgets, they have one budget. If they can justify the supplies against their goals, they can buy the supplies. Does that make sense?
So absolutely.
I've created those kind of efficiencies in my small operation.
So essentially the actions of the legislature that capped funding, or at least froze it, forced the university to find ways to stretch a dollar further. Would that be fair to say? You guys have had to find ways to become more efficient with the dollars. Than in previous practices. Would that not be fair statement? Because that's what you made to believe.
Yeah, well, I think in a Parkside context, we were already running lean.
Yet you're operating on less money than the last budget, correct?
The request, I think, is, and we're not at System creating the budget, so that's a different thing. So we're part of this budget. We need the money for it. Yes, we've worked very hard to be very efficient, but some of the problems we have is we're too lean. At some point, it becomes counterproductive, and I think we're right at that point right now. We can operate the way we are. If we added, I mean, I think we've talked about it, if we had 1,000 students, we aren't going to increase administration whatsoever. not at this point, we'll keep it where it's at. But the other thing that I want you to know is we have real issues because we haven't done anything for our employees. There's been no salaries. There's been, since I've been here 5 years, 1% and a 1%, and at the same time increasing the amount of contribution to health insurance and retirement, both. So it's tough. It's getting tougher and tougher. And we just talked about it this morning at Cabinet, is one of our disruptors is how do we get good people? Higher education used to attract tons of great applicants. Now it's higher education is, are they going to be cut again? They don't get any salary increases. Why would we want to go to work there? And so
we're not talking about the academic side,
no,
per se. We're talking about Mel's context, right, of hiring maintenance staff, hiring HR professionals. Right. You're in a pretty competitive marketplace.
That's happening at Madison.
Yeah, I'm sure it is all across. But you're asking awesome cross questions because they are relevant. No, we have streamlined. We've had to because of the cuts.
Yeah, my point is, from the overall system, did they hand down certain efficiency measures that you guys had to reach, or did you guys go out and your whole staff?
Every campus has a different context, and our context is what it is. And as I say, Mel and some of our practices have been recognized across system because we're smart.
Let me just give you a context of it. So you're looking at a park site who's going to just be 50, and you look at a campus that's over 100 years old. It sounds like, oh, so what's the difference? Financially, it's huge. All the great years of higher ed funding and whatnot, those campuses got them. And so when the cuts come, I was at a larger campus at one point, we had cuts. It wasn't quite as hard because it's like John said, I had some middle managers and other things I could cut back. We don't even have a dedicated budget officer that other campuses have, maybe five in a budget office. So there's that whole disparity of size, and that's true in the corporate world as well.
Absolutely.
Supervisor Poole, Supervisor Goodrich, or not Dye. Those two both had questions.
Yeah, I had some concerns, like Supervisor Franco there, about the governor's suggesting changes in his budget, and it doesn't seem like we're going to figure this out tonight. And I think we should wait until the governor comes out with some more clarification what he's doing there and possibly table this thing tonight. I'd make a motion to table.
Okay. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay. Any discussion on the tabling? Supervisor Hellman.
I'm against tabling. I'd rather vote on this now. We think as counties, we know what's best for us. We think we know what works. And we try to tell that to the state and communicate that. Our local university is trying to do the same thing, and I think we should listen and follow through.
Frankly, I think there's a good chance that the governor will cut it. And I don't see the point of waiting. I think he's going to, frankly. Okay. I don't see why he wouldn't. He's frozen it for 3 years. He cut $250 million out of the budget before and the previous budget. I think there's a good chance that he would cut it. And then all you're doing is shifting more burden on, well, many of the things that they were saying. But anyway, go ahead, Andy.
If we table it, we don't talk about it until mid-February again. It's too late. We table it until mid-February next month. Then it goes to the 1st of March. Well, by that time, it's already possibly going to be approved in the state side. So there's is no influence from us at all. So I'm against tabling it.
Okay. Anyone else?
Would it be out of order for me to say something at this point?
It would be right now. We're talking about tabling it.
I'm looking at, this is a Board of Regents budget. It's not.
And what I'm going to do is, Emily, if you could do a roll call on this.
Boyd Frederick?
No.
David Hallman?
No.
Andy Berg?
No.
Aaron Decker?
Yeah.
John Franco?
No.
John Poole?
Yes.
Michael Skalitsky?
Yes.
And Youth and Governance, Emma Heller-Kapner?
No.
knows one, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So we're back on, is there...
Do you have an idea of what the average student debt is that is graduating?
I think so.
It's between 25 and 28, somewhere like that.
For 4 years or 2 years?
For four years. I'd have to look that up. But that's about the ballpark.
That's fine.
And that's a bit high.
You think that, when you say that's a bit high, do you feel that it's too high for a student to graduate with? Or do you think that's a reasonable number? Because it's certainly much less than you hear some of the horror stories of some of these knuckleheads that are going to college.
The biggest issue is that that number includes public and private. And clearly, the amount of loans you need to take out for a subsidized university such as ours help keep the cost down. We would like to see our students with a little less debt, but right now that's much lower than you're going to see at many of, you know.
So the 28 is for Parkside.
That's our debt.
Okay. Any ideas of, I don't know, just let's say, you know, and I know tuition at Madison is much higher, but let's say Eau Claire is an example. How do you guys, I know you said you're the low cost, right? But it depends if you can graduate in 4 years because you can get all your classes, or is it stretched to five, right?
Those are the things that are going to be impacted if Parkside, not the UW system, if Parkside sustains continued cuts, is time to graduation. That's a big part of what we're trying to do with the $42.5 million that's outlined in terms of how are we going to increase access to tuition and classes. So, for example, more online classes, more summer classes, more winterum or J-term, as they're called. All those things help students get done faster, because if they can get done faster, they're going to be in the marketplace sooner, and they're going to make more money.
One other question. You had mentioned about your flexibility, about creating new classes, but also that means limiting certain curriculum, right? That's not relevant to the marketplace that we're dealing with now. Can you speak a little bit about what you guys have done in a proactive way in that area?
Well, the students choose their classes because we're so small. They vote with their feet. If they don't take the classes, it's not offered, and we don't have a critical mass of students to convince to take certain classes because they're trying to graduate. So I would submit that we're pretty efficient in terms of our class offerings, and we have to be, particularly in the gen eds, if you will, making sure that they're readily available, and we continue to work on it. And yes, we have improvements, but we continue to work on it under the leadership of Chancellor Ford. The programs we have offered are driven by market conditions. So we are looking at all those gateway agreements are critical. They're in the area of business and marketing, because we know they're needed. We've just signed one with Gateway in the area of IT because we know we have a good computer science program if they complete here. We're looking at completing an agreement in fire science because you can complete a 2-year degree at Gateway and then we can give them a 4-year credential before they head out into the marketplace. So at a place like Parkside, it's pretty efficient in terms of what we offer. We do offer arts programming and humanities, but the largest set of majors right now at the University of Wisconsin Parkside is science. We have more students majoring in science than any other discipline in the university, which is shocking to many people because they think, oh, they're taking all these classes. Literally, Parkside students, in my estimation, and the data bears out, are highly practical and focused on career, and that's why you see science, nursing, doctor, applied health sciences. So I'm very proud to tell you that we are creating more scientists than ever before, and the students are continuing to do that. I could give you more data, but I can't tell you the science and business is our largest.
Okay, the chairman won't let you go.
You brought up a great point. Another thing that we're doing is much more cross-disciplinary. The App Factory that did the Kenosha Transit, that has like art students in it all the way to design, marketing, whatnot. So it causes them to really work in an environment that would be in a business setting.
We have to go in 10 minutes, and Supervisor Deck has a question for you real quick.
What is the average starting salary of someone that graduates from Parkside?
Well, it depends on discipline, obviously. I mean, the computer science graduates are getting offers of $70,000 and $90,000.
Okay, you know, and others?
It depends on the discipline. What's a first-year teacher make in the Kenosha Unified? That would be what our teacher candidates are getting
How about science? You're saying science.
Well, it depends. I mean, my son just graduated from college, not Parkside, but he got hired at a pharmaceutical company down the road that we all know of, and he's making more than his mom at $65,000. So, you know, it depends on the discipline. On an average, there was a Biz Times article that says it's about $40,000. We were just highlighted in the Biz Times as the best ROI in the metro region for all four-year schools because of the cost of tuition and the earning potential of our graduates. It was only about $40,000, which I think is a little low, but the average, so what they're paying and what they're getting in return, we were the only four-year in the top five. The rest were tech colleges. You have a lot to be proud of here with Parkside, is what I'm suggesting.
Supervisor Howard, then we pretty much have to head up.
And there's a sheet for the Department of Workforce Development that lays every single profession broken down by regional development, workforce development area. So in our case, the Tri-County area, Racine, Kenosha, and Walworth, and what the starting salary is for that, the experience required, whether it requires a degree, there's a whole spreadsheet on that, Supervisor Decker, that can answer all of that for you.
I don't have that in front of me.
I can get it for you.
But I wish I had that, but it is specific to disciplines.
I'd like to make a motion to approve this.
Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion on the motion?
Well, I was not going to support this resolution to begin with because I think that the UW system has been overindulged for too many years. Tuitions are skyrocketing, and efficiencies weren't forced through as they are in the private sector, which I do work. When budgets get tight, efficiencies are found. But I do want to commend you guys because you articulated to me that you were able to bring your operating budget down. That's exactly what this was for, is I think there's just a little bit too much fat in the UW system, in my own personal opinion. Okay. You don't guys have running it's out the door
as far as...
Attrition, so I'm glad to see that you guys did. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
No, it was on the passage of on the motion, but you were going to other stuff.
Yeah, okay,
so
thank you.
I was trying to. Okay, there's a motion on the floor. Let's do a roll call on this as well.
Okay, Boyd Frederick?
Yes.
David Hallman?
Aye.
Andy Berg?
Yes.
Aaron Decker?
No.
John Franco?
Yes.
John Poole?
No.
Michael Skalitsky?
No.
Emma Heller-Kavner?
Yeah.
Okay. Motion passes 4-3. Anything else to come before the committee before this evening? Is there a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Aye. Upstairs.
Thank you for your time. Wait, you guys sign the resolution.
Hey, do y'all need your autographs?
Thank you for your time.